Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon on the program today. Crisis at the Assembly of First Nations. Allegations of corruption, backroom deals and payouts made by the national chief, Roseanne Archibald, against her own organization. That has led to her shocking suspension by the organization. On National Indigenous Peoples Day, a day to celebrate Indigenous culture, is that top organization suddenly melting down? We'll dig into the controversy and the consequences. Also, is virtual parliament a prudent strategy or just a political way to duck accountability? The Liberals say they want virtual options for parliament. The Tories say they want everyone back on the Hill. What's really at stake here? MPs are here to debate that, plus parliamentary panic buttons.
We need to make sure that anyone who steps up to serve their community at any level of politics is safe, and that's what we're taking very seriously.
Facing increasing threats, MPs are outfitted with panic button. What's the actual threat? We'll dig into that. All that plus, did the RCMP commissioner actually try to jeopardize the investigation into the mass murder in Nova Scotia for political reasons? Shocking new allegations in the Nova Scotia Mass Casualty Commission report just emerging now. We'll dig into those as well. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. Federal COVID-19 vaccine mandate for air and rail travel has dropped. The federal vaccine mandate for public servants dropped. The vaccine mandate for Ottawa's parliamentary precinct dropped. The House's hybrid sitting model, not dropped. Government House Leader Mark Holland introduced a motion last night to extend these hybrid in-person virtual sitting model through 2023. MPs adopted the hybrid model, of course, for committees and House proceedings during the pandemic and created a phone app to allow for remote voting. Holland says the hybrid model allows for flexibility as, quote, this pandemic continues. The Conservatives say no. The proposed extension is an unjustified and unnecessary and allows the government to duck accountability. But as some workers never had the luxury of working from home during the pandemic and other places are transitioning back to in-person, is it fair for the House to keep the hybrid model? What's at stake here? To talk about that and lots more, the government House Leader Mark Holland joins us. Mark Holland, I want to get at all that, but before I do, I've just got a hold of this Mass Casualty Commission, and I'm sure you've seen it into the 2020 Nova Scotia mass shooting, and it alleges that the RCMP Commissioner, Brenda Luckey, tried to interfere with the investigation and jeopardize it for political reasons. And I'm going to read you a section. It says here, the commissioner said she'd promised the public safety and the prime minister's office that the RCMP would release this information. It says here, at a meeting, Commissioner Luckey expressed disappointment in press briefings carried out by the Nova Scotia RCMP. In particular, the commissioner felt the Nova Scotia RCMP had disobeyed her instructions to include specific information on firearms used by the perpetrator. The Superintendent Campbell indicated he'd been told by the Nova Scotia RCMP Strategic Communications Unit not to release the information about the perpetrator's firearm out of concern that it would, quote, jeopardize the ongoing investigation into the perpetrator's access to firearms. And then, according to the superintendent notes, Luckey said she'd promised the Minister of Public Safety and the Prime Minister's office we would release this information. Did the commissioner promise the PMO that she would release this information, jeopardizing the investigation?
Well, first of all, the circumstances surrounding this mass shooting are incredibly tragic and deeply disturbing, and something that that I think is profoundly upsetting to all Canadians, both when it happened and afterwards. What I can say is that the RCMP is independent. It is not directed in any way politically, and in all of its actions, it acts independently.
So again, according to Superintendent Campbell's notes, this is from the commission, his notes, Commissioner Luckey stated, this is a quote, sir, she'd promised the Minister of Public Safety and the Prime Minister's office that the RCMP would release the information on his firearms. You're saying she never promised the PMO and that the Commissioner of the RCMP never promised the Public Safety Minister that they would release this before the gun control legislation that your government tabled?
Well, no, what I'm saying is that the minister responded today in question period to this. I think he was very clear. I don't have any more information than that. Obviously, this is something that I was just hearing about in terms of those notes. But the minister was very clear today, I think, both in terms of the independence and the lack of involvement in his comments and question period. So that's the extent of what I've heard. I've not had any additional information on it, but I thought the minister was very clear in question period today.
Okay, let me just just one more, and I know this is not necessarily your mandate, but you're the House leader. Superintendent Campbell's notes, I'm reading from the Mass Casualty Commission, indicate that when he attempted to explain the reasoning for not releasing this information, Commissioner Lucky stated that we, Nova Scotia RSMP, didn't understand that this was tied to pending gun control legislation that would make officers and the public safer by or through this legislation. That the RCMP commissioner was acting to try to help your government pass gun control legislation. I just want it clear. You're saying she's independent. Superintendent Campbell is suggesting she's not, that she's an agent of your government to help you pass legislation and was jeopardizing the investigation. Is that true? Is there any merit to that?
Look, the minister was very clear in question period today about the independence of the RCMP. I think he answered that question. It's on my file. I don't have a lot more to comment on it than that, but I thought the minister answered in a very fulsome way today.
Okay, and I'm just going to last. Would it be inappropriate for the RCMP commissioner to be telling another police officer to release information on an investigation, and I'm quoting, because she had promised the public safety minister and the prime minister that the RCMP would release that information? Would that be appropriate, or would that be inappropriate?
Look,
and crossing lines?
As I said, and I'm the House Leader, not the Public Safety Minister, but I can tell you again that there is a very firm wall that exists between the RCMP and politics, and that wall has always been respected, and the Minister answered today to that effect.
Okay, the Mass Casualty Commission clearly suggesting, according to Superintendent Campbell's notes, there is no wall, and that wall was clear, according to them, was breached. Let me go to hybrid parliament, which is why you're here. And I appreciate your answering questions about that, Mr. Holland, because it's a big story, as you know, because that's a very significant. Many Canadians still had to go to work in person during the pandemic. There are now no restrictions in most provinces. Why should parliament have hybrid sittings still when most Canadians, including the public service, are told it's time to get back to work?
Well, just as one example, we had five members of parliament just within our own caucus who had COVID last week. And what that means is that they wouldn't have been able to participate otherwise. It's essential as we continue to move through this pandemic that MPs be given the opportunity to represent their constituents. And what I've said is that we're going to continue these provisions for a year, and we're going to ask the Procedure and House Affairs Committee, it's a committee of parliament with all parliamentarians participating, to participate in that process to determine what, if any, utilization of the hybrid provisions can be used in a post-pandemic reality. But, you know, Evan, I remember during Omicron, that, you know, folks were coming forward and saying, you know, this is dead. The Conservatives say end hybrid parliament. There's no need for hybrid parliament. We should have ended it in November. They were saying all of these same things. And then, of course, Omicron hit and we had to use these provisions all over again. And as I mentioned, we're still using them for people today. So I appreciate the Conservatives are opposed to it. But the Bloc Québécois, the NDP and ourselves believe that we need to maintain that flexibility so that we don't keep relitigating this every time we deal with a new variant in this pandemic. Being able to give Parliament that stability and predictability, I think, is important.
They think it's not stability and predictability. They think it's about accountability. And I know you've accused the Conservatives of obstructing your party's legislative agenda, but your party has been moving time allocation motions and midnight sittings to limit debate and advance legislation. Does that contribute to the loggerheads? You know, why not get everyone together, forget the virtual stuff, put everyone together and resolve the issues like that?
Well, Evan, I mean, first of all, the midnight sittings don't limit debate. They increase it because they extend the hours at which the House operates. In terms of a moving time allocation, understand that I tried working with the Conservatives. I take C8 as an example, which was dealing with a number of essential supports for Canadians. That bill, it took 4 months to get through the House. And we eventually had the time allocated because the Conservatives kept saying, well, you know, we're going to do one more speaker and have more speakers. We won't tell you how long it's going to go on for. And at a certain point in time, you realize you're being played. And that their real objection is to block anything from being done. So what, and you have one party that is essentially blocking the other parties who represent 70% of the House, roughly, from doing the work of the House and adopting essential legislation. Hybrid has nothing to do with that. I mean, the Conservatives' decision to block everything was their decision. It's completely independent from hybrid. The reality is hybrid simply right. allowed members who would otherwise not be able to participate to participate, to make sure that they are able to continue to represent their constituents as we move through a public health emergency.
All right, so hybrid sittings. Okay, Government House Leader Mark Holland, first of all, I really appreciate you joining us. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks so much, Adam.
Okay, so there's lots going on here. We were talking about hybrid sittings, but this new report about the Mass Casualty Commission out of Nova Scotia relating to the 2020 horrific mass shooting is really astonishing stuff. And again, we're getting hold of that. Credit to the Halifax Examiner, which first published some of this. But you just heard from the Liberal government House Leader weigh in on that. Let's get the opposition in. Conservative House Leader John Broussard is here. So is the NDP House Leader Peter Julian. Gents, first of all, good to see you. Can I start with this Mass Casualty Commission because it's significant? And I'll start with you, Mr. Broussard. According to, on April 28th, 2020, Nova Scotia RCMP members, and a bunch of them, spoke with the Commissioner Brenda Luckey. And they have handwritten notes from Superintendent D. Campbell. And he alleges that Brenda Luckey, the Commissioner, was pressing the RCMP to include specific information about the firearms of the perpetrator. He said it would jeopardize the ongoing investigation, but he said, quote, Luckey said she'd promised the Minister of Public Safety and the Prime Minister's office we would release this information and that it was tied to pending gun control legislation. I'm quoting here. John Broussard, I just asked Mr. Holland about that. He said there should be an independent wall between the RCMP. What does this tell you?
Evan, I'm trying to digest this because, I mean, I brought it up in the House of Commons this afternoon. You know, if there's any suggestion or any truth, and look, you know, Superintendent Campbell or Commander Campbell was writing notes. He was writing notes, and that's what police officers are trained to do. Those notes were part of the Commission of Inquiry. In those notes, he said that the Commissioner of the RCMP, as you said, told him that she was being asked by the Prime Minister's office and the Public Safety Minister's office to for information. If that's political interference in its highest level, and I go back, this is something that this government has done in the past, Evan. Obviously, the SNC-Lavalin scandal, when the Prime Minister said that the story in the Globe was false. I have no reason to not believe a police commander on the ground in Nova Scotia who is in the middle of an investigation in which 19 people were killed, including one of their police officers. This is a commander who's trying to deal with all of this stuff. And here comes the commissioner of the RCMP saying that she's acting on behalf of the Prime Minister's office and the Public Safety Minister's office a week before there's gun regulations that are being imposed. They're politicizing this issue in order to further their ideological agenda on gun control. It's sick. It's actually gross, Evan, to hear this information today that's coming out of the commission. It's gross.
I'm going to go to Peter Julian. And again, I just want people to understand, there's about 150 pages. I'm looking at page 102, okay? And I just want people to see what we're reading here. These are not allegations. I'm reading from the report, okay? As Mr. Broussard said, this is handwritten notes from Superintendent Campbell, who is on the investigation into this horrific mass casualty events. And I'm going to read this, Mr. Julian. According to Superintendent Campbell's notes, Commissioner Luckey, she's the commissioner of the RCMP, stated that, quote, she had promised the Minister of Public Safety and the Prime Minister's office that the RCMP would release this information. And she said, quote, the RCMP in Nova Scotia didn't understand that this was tied to pending gun control legislation that would make officers and public safer through this legislation. What? And again, this is what I'm reading from here, from the notes. What does that tell you, House Leader Julian?
Well, I haven't read the report, and I know that our public safety critic, Alistair McGregor, is on top of this file. And I hope that you have a panel with the public safety critics. I think that would be an important discussion. It is very true that there needs to be an independent wall between the police services and the government. And Bill Blair today was very clear. He wasn't hedging around. He was saying that there was no direction, what is being alleged wasn't true. This obviously bears further examination. And I think in the coming days, we will hopefully come to the truth of the matter. But there is no doubt that there is an independent wall that is supposed to exist. And if those facts are true, they're very disturbing.
Okay, we are going to reach out to get more on this, Mr. Broussard, as we will pursue this. These are stunning notes. They're not even allegations. They're notes from an evidence presented to the commission. Guys, I just have a minute, gentlemen. Mr. Broussard, what's the case against virtual parliament? Like, why not? It's been working. If someone's sick, they can still vote. Let's say a member is pregnant and gives birth and they're at home. Now they don't have to miss a vote. Why not use this modern technology that allow people actually to have more votes if they happen to be absent or not?
Well, this is the seat of power in Ottawa. People get elected as members of parliament. The expectation is when they do run and among their constituents that this is the place that they're going to be. I'm not saying that hybrid didn't serve a purpose at the height of the pandemic when there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear, but it's beyond that time. I've heard Peter and I've heard Mark talk about some variant that's coming in the fall. I didn't realize that they were doctors. I sent a letter actually on May 31st to all of the House leaders with what I thought was reasonable and practicable suggestions on how we can return safely. And why are we making this decision in the last week of Parliament when we're dealing with inflation and affordability issues in this country that are affecting Canadians? We can in August or September revisit this issue, and if there's a need, we've proven over the last couple of years that we can do it. If there's a need to do it, then we can make that decision in August and September. This is simply, Evan, plain and simple, the Liberals and the NDP hiding away from transparency and accountability. They want their members working their ridings for close election purposes. That's what they're trying to accomplish here. It's all about accountability, transparency, and it really diminishes our democracy. It's a decline in democracy, frankly.
And yet the NDP supports it, Mr. Julian. Why?
Of course they do.
Well, that's wild talk from Mr. Broussard. First off, when a member is sick, when a member misses a flight, their constituents are deprived of their voice and their vote if we don't have the hybrid parliament. The Conservatives weren't cooperative when Omicron hit, and there were major concerns, but we ended up having to spend a number of days of debate just to renew a mandate that it was already in place. The reality is 150 Canadians died last week from COVID. There is still a presence, and having the hybrid parliament allows all constituents to have their voice and vote regardless of what the circumstances are. The Prime Minister was sick with COVID last week. A number of ministers were sick as well. A number of other MPs. This way, their constituents are not deprived of their voice and their vote. And it for the life of me, I don't understand the reaction from Conservatives. The NDP has been pushing hard in the House of Commons. We have a question period. We have all of the tools available to us. But if a member of parliament has to be in their riding because of an emergency, they're no longer being deprived of all of their constituents being deprived of their voice and their vote. If somebody is sick, they're no longer being deprived all their constituents of their voice, their vote. It just makes good sense to extend it. And procedure in House Affairs democratically will be looking at this issue and will be making recommendations over the course of the next few months. This is something the Conservatives should be agreeing to, and instead they're opposing it for reasons that are very difficult to fathom.
All right. Unfortunately, gents, I got to leave it there. But there's lots to pick up on, both on the Mass Casualty Commission and what we've learned there and on how our democracy functions. But I really do appreciate Peter Julian and John Broussard joining me. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, turmoil within the AFN after the Executive Committee and the National Board of Directors vote to suspend the National Chief Roseanne Archibald. She alleges there's corruption inside the AFN and she's being turfed because of that. Where does this organization go from here? This is a big day for Indigenous culture, and yet the top organization is in disarray. We'll dig into what's really going on. Stay with us. Turmoil turmoil right now within the Assembly of First Nations, it's remarkable. The national chief, Roseanne Archibald, the first female national chief, one of the most powerful Indigenous leaders in the country, has been suspended from her role. She claims she's being silenced for, quote, speaking her truth about what she says is corruption and payouts inside the Assembly of First Nations. She said she's trying to expose it, and she's being silenced. The executive branch said no, she breached her obligations as leader, and will stay suspending pending an outcome of an investigation into four complaints against the national chief for things like bullying. What is happening inside this critical national body? Is it a problem of leadership or more? Look, we're discussing this on National Indigenous Peoples Day. This is a day when Archibald calls for healing. This is a day to celebrate Indigenous culture, but the critical organization is literally in disarray. We called almost every single regional chief in the country to speak about this. No one would speak, but we do have Negan Sinclair, professor at the University of Manitoba and a columnist with the Winnipeg Free Press, and Pam Palmiter, a Mi'kmaq lawyer specializing in Indigenous and human rights law, the chair in Indigenous governance at Toronto Metropolitan University. Great to have you both here. Pam, let me just start with you. I'll be candid. I have spoken to both sources on both sides of this, some saying the national chief should be suspended for this and there's real issues in there. Others say this is classic chauvinism and other issues against her. What should we read into this, and what does it say about the organization that they've suspended the national chief?
Well, I think, first of all, without, you know, making a decision on who's right or who's not, it's an absolute embarrassment and a shame that the organization itself, the Assembly of First Nations, would, first of all, allow this to play out in public, and to even think that they could suspend a national chief, regardless of what internal staffing issues there may be. This isn't an employee situation. She's voted in by the chiefs. She's voted out by the chiefs. So I'm curious to see what their actual authority is to suspend a national chief for staffing issues that should be dealt with by human resources.
Negan, again, from the outside, people look at the AFN as a critical organization. All of a sudden, the national chief is suspended. She's putting up press releases saying there's corruptions and big payouts to staff, and she's got evidence. There's yet bullying allegations against her. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, I mean, Pam's absolutely right. And, you know, no one would know the situation better than Pam, who ran for national chief just a few elections ago. So, you know, taking her word seriously, it is a real sort of constitutional crisis at the Assembly of First Nation, in that do they really have the authority to remove the national chief and on a situation that has really played out in a very ugly way? On, you know, on one level, I mean, Roseanne Archibald, since she campaigned on this very issue, talking about cleaning up the situation within the AFN, the fact that it's an old guard association, it's very male dominated, you know, and to the tune of almost 80 to 90% of chiefs in Canada are male. And women historically have been in situations, many reports have indicated over the years that women have been mistreated or treated much less in a political way, in a way in which they don't carry major roles within the organization or certainly get elected in as national chief. This is a terrible look for the organization, and it's also a terrible look because it's not just removing the first female national chief elected democratically by the chiefs, but there have been questions about the legitimacy of an election involving the fact it was a virtual election. So people are saying that this election was not appropriate because it was held during a pandemic and there wasn't the allotted 60% of chiefs. You know, many chiefs didn't participate within that virtual election too. So, I mean, there are many systemic issues within the organization. It's really shown that the AFN is a really old guard, very male dominated, and is not used to change. And then you have a national chief who's evoking nothing but change. It's a real, I think, critical juncture for the organization.
Although there's complaints against her, again, I don't know the merits of all this. Pam Palmiter, when you get allegations of corruptions and big payout from the national chief who's been suspended, when you get complaints against the national chief that the executives say merit a suspension, what needs to happen to reestablish some kind of credibility in this crisis?
Well, I think at this point, the AFN has created such a mess as an organization that they're going to need some kind of independent oversight, independent analysis or audit, for example. And the way I see it in politics, if you have nothing to hide, then open the books. But it looks like there's a huge resistance to having any kind of audit or investigation. I don't know if the allegations that the national chief are making are true, but there's certainly one way to find out. But I think at the end of the day, you have to really look at these two sides. You've got, you know, a potential staff complaint, which should have been dealt with by HR within AFN, versus these massive allegations. And you have to wonder, was she suspended because of like staffing issues, or is it because she was working on an audit and trying to get to the bottom of financial issues?
I just have a minute here, but Negan, as I understand it, every year there already is an audit. There's an independent Deloitte audit of the finances presented to the chiefs every July at the meeting. I understand there is an audit already. Isn't there already an audit done on the finances?
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's been a part of any organization knows that these large-scale audits often don't catch what the National Chief Archibald is calling for, or former National Chief Archibald. I mean, I don't even know what to call her right now. She's calling for a forensic audit. That means a look to see within the very merits of every program, every situation, every employee situation. What are the ways in which those employees were paid for distancing themselves? And she's talking about going back to the days of Perry Bellegarde, which, of course, we know involved a great deal of large-scale issues that were allegations against Perry Bellegarde in the last days of him as national chief. So this is going to the very top echelons and to the very, very deep older issues that she is trying to address.
All right. Well, we'll see where this goes, especially on a day when obviously it's an important day. But when the organization is in this kind of disarray, here we are covering this. Negan Sinclair, Pam Palmer, I know we'll be talking again. I really appreciate you joining us. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, Miigwech, thanks.
Coming up, Trump pressure campaign. What pressure did local election officials face in light of Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the election? Extraordinary testimony again today from the January 6th Capitol riot hearings. And Joy Malbon has the latest from Washington next. Stay with us. The House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol riot began its fourth day of public hearings today. The panel hearing testimony from officials in key battleground states who fended off the former President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election.
This pressure campaign brought angry phone calls and texts, armed protests, intimidation, and all too often threats of violence and death.
The committee is hearing from Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who received a phone call from the former president days before the January 6th riot, where he demanded that Raffensperger find enough votes, like over 11,000 votes, to flip the state and prevent Biden from winning.
I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
Mr. Secretary, was the president here asking you for exactly what he wanted, one more vote than his opponent?
What I knew is that we didn't have any votes to find. We had continued to look. We investigated, like I just shared the numbers with you. There were no votes to find. That was an accurate count that had been certified.
Raffensperger says the votes in Georgia were counted by hand and counted by machine several times, which showed all the President Trump's comments were not true, and President Biden clearly won the state. Let's bring in CTV National News Washington Bureau Chief Joy Malbon on this. Describe the pressure campaign that was being testified on today and what was significant about it, Joy.
It was really stunning and powerful testimony from an Arizona House Speaker who not only voted for Trump twice, a staunch Republican, wanted him to win this election, And yet you could see the struggle in his eyes and in how he described how there were these plots to overturn the election. And he said he just couldn't do it. He took an oath. He just couldn't do it at all. And then, of course, you've played a little bit of sound and video from some of the state officials in Georgia. And these were swing states, Georgia, Arizona, a few others, where Trump thought, if I could just swing this state, if I could do this. But this the pressure was just so intense, especially when Trump supporters started harassing a lot of these state officials at their homes. They were doxxed. Information about their family was put out there. And they were saying such vile things. I mean, calling one state official a pedophile and corrupt on loudspeakers. But some of the more powerful testimony came from an election worker and her mother. They're just doing their job, counting the votes. But Donald Trump and his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, they put out this false claim that somehow they had these suitcases stuffed with ballots for Joe Biden, and somehow they were trying to steal the election from them. Well, Trump supporters got online, and the threats and the harassment that these two women faced, one quote stands out to me. Ruby Freeman, the mom of Shay Moss, said that, can you imagine being targeted by the president of the United States? Can you imagine that kind of pressure? The fact that they withstood this and would not do anything illegal is astounding.
Another day, this is the fourth day, more astonishing testimony about this. CTV's Joy Malbon in Washington. Joy, a riveting testimony. Thank you for talking about that. From Washington, we go to Ottawa, the international airport, where CTV National reporter Kevin Gallagher is standing by, not to talk about delays at the airport, but he's on his way to Rwanda, where the Prime Minister is headed for a big trip. He's going to Rwanda, Germany, Spain. What is on the agenda? What is going on this trip, Kev?
You know, one of the top priorities, Evan, that we've heard that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau wants to get across is really condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine, getting support from international partners for Ukraine, but also some of the side effects of that conflict, food scarcity. You know, according to the World Food Program, Ukraine before this war would feed 400 million people a year with the food it can grow and export. So there's some real concerns about famine and hunger hitting parts of the Middle East, Africa, the Caribbean. These are areas where used to get a lot of Ukrainian wheat and grain. But the issue, of course, here is that there's a lot of Commonwealth members that, of course, Justin Trudeau want to talk to. But, for example, India really hasn't, given a lot of support to Ukraine in this stage right now. They have closer ties to Russia. There's some African countries that still really rely on Russian wheat. So that might be a tougher sell for some of the Commonwealth countries. And it happens at a time as well when you got Human Rights Watch asking Commonwealth members really to call out the host nation, Rwanda, for its, less than clean human rights record. Of course, there's allegations that they are, censoring the media, suppressing dissent and so on. So all of this could make for some interesting discussion. The theme of the Commonwealth Conference is really moving together, in the future, a common goal looking forward. And a lot of that discussion is going to focus around sustainability and climate change. But there's bound to be some, pitfalls and perhaps some disagreements when it comes to what best to do for the international community to try and improve food security around the world, but also what to do about Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah, not everyone on that same sheet. Lots of different needs out there. Okay, Kevin Gallagher, I know you got to get on that plane. There's a long trip ahead. Thanks, Kevin. We'll hear reports from Kevin throughout this long trip. We are taking a break, but coming up, responding to rising threats against members of Parliament, the press galleries, not only going to talk about these safety issues, do they need a panic button, but it's report card season. We'll talk about that. Stay with us. Who's getting their grades today, including this guy? Welcome back. Responding to a new threat environment on Parliament Hill, the Public Safety Minister Marco Mendicino says MPs are getting panic buttons to get enhancing their personal security as reports of harassment and intimidation keep ramping up. These mobile duress alarms, as they're called, would alert the Parliamentary Protective Service or local police. MPs are also being taught how to de-escalate violent situations being offered by security assessments of constituency offices and homes. So, is this the reality elected officials face? And to talk about that, and to talk about the end-of-season report cards on performance. The press gallery is here. Bob Fife, the Globe and Mail's Ottawa bureau chief, and Fatima Sayed, reporter with the Narwhal and the host of the political podcast Backbench, is here. Bob, I remember Privy Counsel Michael Warnick, his testimony during the SNC-Lavalin affair, where he said, "I fear for the state of political discourse," and he worried, quote, "someone's going to get shot." Is there a need for panic buttons?
Unfortunately, Evan, I think there is a need for it. I've talked to members of parliament and cabinet ministers from all political parties, and all of them have expressed concern about rising anger amongst people, fueled partly by, largely, I think, by social media, but also by the freedom protest, or the so-called freedom protest, where there's been a lot of anger directed at politicians. And they're all kind of concerned for their safety, and this is something that we really haven't seen before.
Well, Fatima, we're looking at safety. This is on a day where the fourth testimony on the January 6 riots on Capitol Hill, the unimaginable will happen there at the turn of that election. Is this about a new threat environment for elected officials?
I think this environment has been coming up on us for a while now, Evan, especially for politicians who are engaging with constituents and the country online. There have been so many reports in the last several years warning that this is the case, that online vitriol is becoming more and more threatening and dangerous. And you know, could lead to possible violence. I remember when Catherine McKenna's office was vandalized, for example, and so many other MPs have reported just, you know, being harassed by people on the streets and in restaurants and so forth. So this is a reality. Whether a panic button is constructive is the main question, right? Like, we need to address the core problem, which is addressing why these people are making these threats in the first place and how they're getting away with it. That means engaging with online platforms, which is a whole can of worms that the government hasn't been able to navigate properly.
Well, let's continue on the theme of safety in the bigger picture, and we'll transition to our power play tradition. Final week, maybe, of the House, we do report cards to key political leaders. And speaking of public safety, we'll start with Marco Mendicino. Look, high-pressure situations like the trucker protest, Bob, the invocation of the Emergencies Act, and did he act on the advice of police, or did he mislead Parliament on that? Public safety, by the way, is in the news right now with this Mass Casualty Commission report that's just out today. He wasn't the minister then. Bill Blair was, I think, but alleging that the RCMP commissioner had promised the Minister of Public Safety and the Prime Minister's office releasing information that potentially could have jeopardized that investigation. How would you grade Marco Mendicino on public safety?
Well, you know, we've got to remember that most of these ministers that we're grading now have been in their positions for less than 9 months. And I think overall, I had been initially impressed with Mr. Mendicino, first as immigration minister, trying to deal with an apartment that needed to be blown up in dealing with the Afghan crisis. And he's, I think, shown a lot of energy and willingness to tackle tough issues as public safety minister, you know, dealing with gun legislation itself as well. But, you know, the problem he has here, and why I don't give him as high a grade, I'm giving him a C, is because it's clear he misled the Parliament and Canadians when he said that the police had asked for the invocation of the Emergencies Act, and they did not ask for it. And he was clear that they did. And, you know, he's got to bear responsibility for that. You've got to be responsible for what you say to the Canadians. And he misled the public and he misled Parliament.
Okay, so Bob, you're giving Marco Mendicino a C, a downgrade because of the explanation as to why he invoked the Emergencies Act. Fatima.
So first of all, I should not be a teacher. This was very, very hard, and I've never done this on the show before, so that's the caveat. I'm also giving Minister Mendicino a C because I'm a results person, right? I want to see what you're going to achieve as minister, and as there has, as you described, Evan, at the top of the show, there have been a lot of scenarios for Mr. Mendocino to deal with this year, and he's just fallen short every single time. I think, you know, part of that is because it seems like our political institutions are not prepared for any crisis that could come our way. But part of it also seems to be a lack of constructive communication coming from the minister himself during the biggest crisis that Ottawa has seen recently, which was, the emergency powers and how it filtered down from Parliament Hill to the rest of the institutions involved. And I don't think to this day he's provided a clear explanation of how that worked and what he's learned from it.
Okay, these are tough grades, but consequential moments. Like, he was in the hot seat on a very consequential series of moments, as you say. Can we take a break? Get ready with your pens. More grades. We're going to be doing this all week. Grades for the Foreign Affairs Minister, Melanie Joly, war in Ukraine. Grade for the Health Minister, Jean-Yves Duclos. Pass, fail, what will they get on COVID and the war? Lots to come on Power Play. It's report card season. Stay with us. So this should be the last week of Parliament. They're going to rise for the summer, so time to hand out report cards. Now, we just graded the Public Safety Minister, Marco Mendocino. He's been in the hot seat over the Emergencies Act, the protests, gun legislation. Let's turn the spotlight on the Foreign Affairs Minister, Melanie Joly. Obviously, there's the war in Ukraine and the Russia invasion. Lots of sanctions there, and frankly, Canada's led the way. But she also had to deal with Buy American, a call to boycott the Olympics in China, pressure on assisting stranded Afghans, the global fight against COVID. What grade does our panel give Melanie Joly, who, remember, one member of her ministry attended a Russian function? A story Bob Fife broke. And good news, Bob Fife, the Globe and Mail Ottawa Bureau Chief, is here. And then Narwhal's Fatima Syed, who hosts the Backbench podcast, is here too. Okay, Bob, how would you grade Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly and her performance?
Well, look, Ms. Joly is a neophyte. She was put into a very big portfolio, and she tried to tackle it with a lot of energy. The key thing here is the war in Ukraine. And she was tasked largely with developing the sanctions and working with other nations in bringing in sanctions, which I think she deserves a lot of credit for. She's also worked very hard as somebody who didn't know anything about foreign affairs to meet other foreign affairs leaders around the world and up her game, so to speak. She's got leadership ambitions, as you well know, Evan, and she is hoping that this portfolio is going to shine a light on her if Mr. Trudeau should leave. But she last week she landed in a lot of trouble when her department approved a senior protocol official going to Russia Day festivities at the embassy here in Ottawa. It was an absolute embarrassment both at home and abroad. But in fairness to Ms. Joly, her staff blew it by not reading an email from the bureaucracy. But more important, the deputy minister approved this and didn't pick up the phone and call Ms. Joly. And in that respect, I think she showed a lot of class, because I would have fired her if it would happen to me. And she didn't do so. So I'm giving her a B minus. And let's see how she performs in the next year.
Yeah, she did. I talked to her about it, and she just said, yep, I bear responsibility. It was bad. It was embarrassing. I own it. Nothing I could do. We didn't get the memo. It was a screw-up. I mean, she didn't even try to spin it, which, at least that to her credit. Fatima. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to be harsher than Mr. Fife, because I just, you know, yes, she had a difficult task of putting Canada on the map at a time when global strife was a lot to deal with, everything from Ukraine to all the subsequent crises that led to. But I think she couldn't constructively, and I keep using that word because I feel like that's a problem with Canadian politics right now, I think she couldn't constructively give us a foreign affairs policy or vision that could take Canada into the next year and address the crises beyond. So for that reason, I'm giving her a C. You know, we don't have an Asia-Pacific strategy to this day, despite the fact that the U.S. has put it out. I think we're focusing so much on Ukraine and our relationship with Europe, we're forgetting our relationship with other countries. She also holds the title in my books for the best quote of the year. I know it's only June, but during a trip to Brussels, she said, and of course, Canada is one of the most European countries in the world while being fiercely North American, which is a very confusing statement, and it kind of tells you all you need to know about how she approaches foreign affairs, in my opinion, again. So I'm not sure what her vision for Canada on the world stage is, and that's why I'm sticking to my C.
Okay, it's a C. Okay, I got about a minute. Duclos, real quick on Duclos and post-COVID. Bob, new Minister of Health.
Okay, look, the guy has no charisma, as you well know, but he is a former economics professor. He has, I think, done a very good job in health so far, but he's got more big challenges ahead of him. The healthcare system is deteriorating, and he's got to step up his game and deal with the provinces improving our healthcare. I give him a B.
So the mark, a B. Okay, okay. Technocrat for sure, Fatima.
I'm consistent. I'm going with a C because I kind of had to Google what he'd been up to this year when he was on the list. I couldn't remember what he's done, which is kind of a problem when we're still in the COVID crisis and the healthcare system is collapsing day by day and getting worse day by day. And the federal health minister really hasn't done much to solve that or start solving that. And that worries me.
Fatima, I do not want to take a class with you. You are the toughest grader around. Bob, can you imagine? Don't grade Bob and I. Bob Fife, Fatima Syed. Man, oh man, tough, man, politics. Thank you, the two of you, for being here as usual. There's lots going on tonight, so make sure you see Lisa LaFlamme on the national news tonight. That's your Power Play Day in politics, though. Thanks for watching. We will be back here in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones. What a privilege that is. Have a great evening. See you back here tomorrow.